Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. Now, folks who listen to my show know that I usually like to chat a little bit about stuff on my mind. But today, I have a guest that I think we'll use every minute of. You also know, if you've heard my show, that I really like my guests. But today is a really special time for me, because I've wanted to get to know this man better for a long time. I'm going to be planning a conference. We're actively planning a conference between his organization, which is the Critical Psychiatry Network, and our Empathic Therapy Center for London next year. And he is the most thoughtful child psychiatrist I know. He does more reform work in the field of mental health than any child psychiatrist I know, any other child psychiatrist. And he's also in a very interesting position because he, while being a critic, is in influential positions in what might be called the establishment. Maybe he'll say he's not, but I think he's in influential positions in the establishment in Great Britain. He's a consultant child psychiatrist, adolescent and child, and he's director of medical education at the National Health Service in Lincolnshire. Bobby didn't pronounce that right. And he's visiting professor also at the University of Lincoln. He's written and edited many good books. One of his better known is Naughty Boys, Antisocial Behavior, ADHD, and the Role of Culture. And another one of his books is The Myth of Autism, just came out. His name is Sammy Tamimi. Sammy Tamimi. Sammy is spelled S-A-M-I. Tamimi is T-I-M-I-M-I. Sammy, are you listening to all this?
Yeah, I can hear you, Peter. That was a bit of a flattering introduction there.
Did I get anything wrong?
No, I don't think so. As I say, I think it was a bit flattering to hear that.
Well, you really deserve it, you know, and you and I have never really got to know each other very much on a personal level, and maybe this radio show will be the beginning of that.
I hope so.
We've been following each other's work for years, obviously.
That's right, yeah.
Why don't you start out maybe and just give folks an idea of how you got some of the places you are now in your thinking, your philosophy, your work, and we'll go on from there because you're doing a lot and you've got a lot of thoughtful approaches. So let me unleash you with just to begin with how you got to the position you're in.
Well, like most things, it's a long story with all sorts of twists and turns. I think one of the first things that got me interested in psychiatry in the first place goes back to when I was a medical student, and I remember in my fourth year placement, when we did psychiatry, we had to interview a number of people and then write up an account of that interview in a kind of standard psychiatric manner. And I remember one of the people that I interviewed who'd had a diagnosis of schizophrenia, she recounted a long story which had a lot of tragedy in it. And it included things like the death of her husband very suddenly, that they'd been trying for children but never had children, and then at some point she develops delusions about having all these children. And I recall that her story sort of somehow made some sort of sense. And so I went to the university library and I got out a book by a psychiatrist, a Scottish psychiatrist, and I went to medical school in Scotland. a Scottish psychiatrist called R.D. Lang, who I didn't know at the time was sort of associated with the 60s counter-psychiatry movement. And this book called The Divided Self, and I found it fascinating, and it talked about how psychosis can be an understandable reaction to extreme circumstances in your life. So I wrote up this case and really went to town with it and wrote it up and went into a lot of detail taking from this book. And I failed that assignment. So I had to go back and do the whole assignment again, but do it in more formal, standardized, mainstream language. And that was my first brush with an encounter with the mainstream psychiatry wasn't quite what I imagined it to be. So then after I finished my medical training and I decided to go into psychiatry, having probably had my appetite whetted a bit by reading R.D. Lang. And for many years, I think I was a reasonably mainstream. I had an interest in psychotherapy from the start. But I also was interested in neuroanatomy and neurology and all the theories that were around at the time. And I did various bits of training. And then at some point, I did my child psychiatry placement and found the whole concept of working with families made a lot of sense to me. And this is now going back to the early 90s when I first encountered child psychiatry. And in those days, at least in Britain, it was still a field where there was a lot of systemic thinking. And so that seemed to make sense to me. So I entered into a training scheme to become to qualify as a consultant in child psychiatry. And then it was just at the time that in the UK we were beginning to get interested in the concept of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, which up until then, at least in the UK, was a rather peripheral condition, not really diagnosed very frequently and certainly very rarely treated with medication. And so the consultant I was working with at the time, who had this growing interest, as did many consultants, asked me to join him in doing a research project looking at ADHD. And so I said, okay, I'll go away and do all the background reading on the literature and kind of try and get my head around what ADHD was. And so the more I read about ADHD, the more confused I became. And this was kind of confusion at a very basic level, because I was still trying to figure out, what is ADHD? Just this basic question. Because I couldn't believe that ADHD is just those symptoms. It is just about a deficit of attention and hyperactivity. Surely there was something more to it than that for it to become a syndrome. Surely the syndrome isn't just those two symptoms. Or three symptoms, which are fairly ordinary symptoms from my point of view, you know, naively thinking, well, you know, I certainly had those behaviors. I certainly see it in the kids around me. And now that I'm a parent myself and have been for many years, I've certainly seen it in my kids. In other words, these weren't qualitatively different behaviors to the sorts of behaviors that you would see in kids without disorders. And the more I searched, and the more I went into the sort of official ADHD research and the official writings and the official definitions, the more I began to see cracks emerging all over the place in this edifice, and the more I began to feel that this was a really constructed notion, that it had no evidential basis. That it was an idea that somebody or some group of people had come up with, and that's all it was. And eventually that was the conclusion I came to. And as I started coming to this, I found myself returning to a lot of those early critical thinkings that I had first encountered as a medical student and some of those texts. And from there, I, as this sort of critical thinking started taking root, and I started searching a bit more in a bit more depth, this whole world opened up of critical writings and people who are like yourself looking at some of these concepts and looking at them through all sorts of different lenses, from an academic point of view, from a philosophical point of view, and also from a practice point of view. And I found that, my whole, if you like, worldview around psychiatry beginning to crumble, that edifice that I had been taught. So that by the time I actually finished my child psychiatry training, I felt almost like I needed some sort of ritual burning of all the books that I'd learned, because I felt I'm going to have to unlearn all of this and go back and start again to really get to grips with this subject. And those musings eventually led to sort of my first book, which was a few years after I became a consultant.
Sammy, when you were reaching these conclusions, you were already officially embedded in the system.
Yep.
Did you run into trouble, difficulty?
I've certainly run into trouble and difficulty at times since then, as many of us in our critical psychiatry network in Britain. It's not an unusual experience, it seems to be, that when you have views and ways of practicing that's considered to be, it's not that the difficulty is, why I'm hesitating is because I don't think our views and our ways of practicing can any longer be considered non-mainstream, because many of us, including myself, have published and published quite widely, including in the mainstream medical journals. So we are part now of the body of medical knowledge, which has actually been a big protective factor. So it's not that we're talking about and practicing in a way that's outside of the mainstream. It is just perceived by some of those who have a narrow view of what psychiatry is as being outside of their conceptions of what a psychiatrist should be doing. So I have my most difficult time was a number of years ago when I was a consultant to an inpatient adolescent unit. So I was having to take referrals from consultant colleagues working in the community, and then we would be working with the young people who came to the unit and they would be returning. And actually, the unit, we did some, I think, some really, really good work. And what was happening that was upsetting some of the colleagues was that people were coming. They were coming to us on medication with various diagnoses and requests for sort of more diagnostic assessments. And they'd be returning to them off medication and without any new diagnosis, and sometimes with old diagnoses taken away. And this was causing some issues. And it was difficult because you can only work in the way that ethically and clinically you feel is appropriate. So I couldn't, you know, with my conscience, work in a way that didn't have those aspects of working, which to me is the evidence-based way of working. But it did result in a really difficult time where there were accusations towards me of clinical incompetence, and I had to get my medical defense union involved, and there were meetings and all. But in the end, actually going through that whole process and successfully defending myself and extracting apologies, and I think proved to be a rewarding experience in that since then, the career in my organization seems to have gone to strength to strength, and now I hold senior management positions, and I'm involved in several wide-ranging projects.
Sammy, I don't think that's possible here in the U.S. Is that your impression, too? I mean, I get the impression, especially talking to you today, that child psychiatry in Great Britain is light years more enlightened than here in the U.S. I mean, I don't think there's anybody like you holding any position in child psychiatry in the U.S. What's your is that your impression too?
I think in the U.K. it does have a bit of a tradition of having a group. It is possible to be skeptical. And it's not necessarily the end of your career if you are skeptical. The critical psychiatry network that we have here, you know, has, as I know you're aware, has many, many psychiatrists on it who are working up and down the country. We have various different views. You know, some of us are more uncomfortable with medication than others, and some of us are more uncomfortable with diagnosis than others. But the being able to have a critical thought about your profession and to debate this and to for that to be something that is also at times valued is, I think, something that is possible to happen in the UK, more so than in the US.
Well, I don't think we have it in the U.S.
There are many other countries in Europe that are certainly less medicalized than the U.K. The U.K. is still quite a medicalized sort of environment when it comes to the models that are used in mainstream psychiatry. So well, certainly not the best that you would come across in Europe, but there's still a healthy debate.
What's the best in Europe, Sammy? What countries have the least medical model, the most psychosocial model?
Well, I don't know enough about what's going on in all the different countries, but two countries come to mind in particular, and that's France and Italy. Italy, of course, they've got the history of the democratic psychiatry movement in the 1970s and Franco Basaglia and passing laws that actually made it illegal to, in some counties in Italy, to admit people to mental hospitals, and they closed all the mental hospitals and moved all the care into the community. And there are still parts of Italy that have that tradition working and lively, and they have projects which involve people with mental health people who've experienced mental health problems and family members of people who've experienced mental health problems who are actually employed to work as part of multidisciplinary teams. They do things like they run their own halfway houses. They run businesses like bed and breakfasts that have guests and also have people who would be called patients in other settings and so on and so forth. So Italy still has a tradition and a history of being quite innovative and quite community orientated. And France has a long history of being more kind of psychoanalytic and psychodynamic and psychotherapeutically minded, and they have a very well-funded health service that seems to afford more psychotherapeutic approaches to happen. So those would be the two countries that come to mind. But I have to say that's a fairly superficial opinion, not one based on
real
depth of knowledge. Yeah.
Now we're gonna. I didn't get a chance to tell you this before we went on the air, but we'll go for another 10 minutes, and then we're gonna take a break.
Okay.
Sammy, that's about 2 or 3 minutes long or whatever. And you and I can actually talk then, if we want to, for a minute or two. But it's sure. a few minute break. So we've got about 10 more minutes to go right now on this first half. Could you just jump into treatment issues about, you know, what does, at its best, at your hands, what kind of help, you know, is a 10-year-old boy who's just impossible to control, or a 15-year-old girl who's hearing voices and is very distressed? Maybe take those two kinds of very different situations and begin a conversation about what at your best are you offering these folks? I'd really love to hear that.
Right. It would be difficult to take such brief scenarios like that. Maybe before going into that, it would be important to take a step back and think about what might not be so helpful. One of the things
sure.
that I think I've really come to the conclusion to and feel very passionately now, from a practice point of view, from a culture point of view, and also particularly from an evidence-based point of view, is that our way of thinking about those types of presentations, by trying to fit them into the idea that we can sort them out into diagnostic categories in the same way that we might sort out, you know, cardiovascular symptoms and signs into meaningful categories, and that these meaningful diagnostic or that these diagnostic categories that we sort them out into provide us with meaningful information about the cause of what's going on and meaningful information about the right treatment, I think this is totally bogus. And I think it's a very dangerous way of operating that we have developed. And what it seems to have led to is an increasing use of, this has been the way in for the increasing use of quite dangerous, and particularly dangerous to young people, medications, and also to the idea of being a patient who will require long-term help. So my starting point, and I think this is an evidence-based starting point, as well as a starting point from a point of view of what I have evaluated to work in practice, is that every person that I see, I have a basic set of assumptions, which is that you and your family have the resources to get better, that whatever it is that you're going through, you can make improvements. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody I see will get better or everybody I see will make improvements, but I think the assumptions that we start with will shape how we begin to explain what's going on and the models of working we choose to take up with people. So if we take up the model of working where we assume that the diagnosis points to something that's broken, if you like, inside the person, that requires an expert-led treatment that only this expert, such as medication, can provide, then you are inviting the person and the family to take on a particular approach and a particular idea about what's wrong with them and about how to solve what's wrong with them, which is likely to stay with them for years and possibly the rest of their life. So, you know, we might be, I often think of diagnosis as one of the most powerful hypnotic suggestions we can make to people. So if we're telling somebody you're hearing voices because you've got a mental illness, and this mental illness is called schizophrenia, and this mental illness is something that can go on for many years, And to keep it at bay, you need to take this medication many years, possibly the rest of your life. You've set up a certain scenario that will get people thinking about what's wrong with themselves in a particular way and thinking about how they stay better. That puts them into the category of a potential long-term mental patient. And all the evidence suggests that this is the pathway that leads to long-term problems, partly due to the types of medications and their dulling effects on your cognitions. But it also then limits the opportunity to reimagine how you might move forward. So if I'm to go back to this idea of working with people who are hearing voices, and I've worked with lots of people who've heard voices over the years, and very few of them have ended up on medication, and most of them have ended up, after a number of sessions, being discharged, feeling much better, ready to get on with their lives, and not necessarily not hearing voices anymore. Some of them are still hearing voices. But if you, for example, and it will depend on the young person and the family and what fits with them and what fits in terms of us having a meaningful and productive therapeutic relationship. But one of the ideas that you can sometimes work with is that usually there is some sort of emotionally overwhelming incident or set of incidents or set of circumstances that have happened to the young person, and you can just talk about hearing voices as one of a range of natural human responses to going through emotionally overwhelming circumstances, and that these types of things tend to become more troubling when you feel the voices have more power over you. So one way of working, which seems to be very helpful for a lot of people, is to start helping the person change their relationship with the voice. And that can include things like naming the voice, and we can give it an age, we can give it an identity, we can get the person to start asking the voice why it's there, what message it's bringing. And that changes the kind of power dynamic between the voice and the voice hearer. So that it doesn't necessarily take away the voice, and that's not the task of what we're working on, but it changes the dynamic and the power relationship. For some people, doing that seems to actually result in the voice just becoming very quiet. Some people disappear. Some people, the voice stays the same, but they're no longer troubled by it. They take it as messages from their unconscious and so on. I don't know if that's giving you a flavor of the sorts of things that I'm talking about and why it's important that we work with models that are more positive, optimistic, and less bound in the idea of some sort of invisible mental illness that can only be cured by an expert.
Well, you know, Sammy, that you just described everything I do and believe.
Yeah, okay. I'm not surprised. Yeah.
What'd you say?
I'm not surprised, having read your work, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you just described that very thoughtfully and very carefully, very subtly. I think it's amazing to me that you have such a strong voice within the National Health Service in Great Britain. You know, I'm thinking back to Bob. Do you know Bob Johnson? You probably know Bob.
I know Bob Johnson very well, yeah.
Yeah. Well, just getting to know each other enough so that I find out we have a very good mutual friend. You know, in Bob's story early in the way long ago in the National Health Service in Great Britain, he refused to do shock treatment on patients and was not able to stay a psychiatrist. And actually was a GP for his entire career. And as he got near to retirement, he started reading some of my books and decided that he was going to finally, you know, stand up on these issues. And I gather that maybe the child psychiatry is just in Great Britain, and I still get a sense, is much more open to these positive influences than the adult psychiatry.
Well, In some ways, you see, I think of myself as a traditional child psychiatrist because, as I say, when I first went into child psychiatry, their systemic thinking was still very much alive.
Yes.
But I have to say it's become been progressively more medicalized in the past decade. As I say, during the time I was training towards becoming a consultant, the medicalization of childhood and in child psychiatry was creeping in, and it's really crept in big time. But it's not taken over completely, that's for sure.
Let's go to break now and bring in the music. And let me hear that music coming. There it is. And Sammy, you and I get a chance to chat a little bit during the break.
Yeah.
Well, welcome back to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour with just a lovely man, a lovely child psychiatrist, a sensitive, caring, thoughtful. His name's Sammy Tamimi. Sammy is spelled S-A-M-I, and his last name, Tamimi, is T-I-M-I-M-I. Sammy's the author of over 100 scientific articles and a number of books, including in 2005, Naughty Boys, a really good book about ADHD and behavior and culture, and more recently, co-author, the first author of The Myth of Autism. And one of the things I thought would be really good is to encourage Sammy to talk some more. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to be with him, and you can join us this summer. We haven't set a date yet. We're hoping to do that very soon for a joint conference in Great Britain next summer, 2015, in London, at a great hotel, really, really well situated. You can meet really, really outstanding people in Great Britain from the Critical Psychiatry Network. And it's going to be in the summer of 2015. And maybe in a week or two or three, Sammy and I can have a date for you. I talked with Sammy during the break, and I'd love to hear just more about how he goes about helping children and their families. And so I'm just going to hand that to you to talk about, Sammy.
Okay, so I think it'd probably be worth doing what I did just before the break and just stepping back again and talking a little bit about why I've come to the conclusion that if we get caught up in questions of diagnosis, questions of yes, he has it, no, he doesn't, for example, we can end up with frameworks that limit the opportunity for us to be a bit more imaginative and a bit more specific with each family and with each young person. Let me kind of give you an example of what I mean. So if you go down the diagnostic route with, let's say, a young person who is presenting with behavior that could be categorized as hyperactive and impulsive and difficulty paying attention, and just putting aside for a minute all the different debates about how you arrive at a cutoff point and its subjective nature and so on. But if you go down the pathway of categorizing someone who presents with such behaviors as having the diagnosis, for example, of ADHD, then, and you use that to start planning how you're going to intervene to help, what you end up doing is the differences between different children who get labeled with that diagnosis become of lesser importance than the particular similarity of these very few behaviors that they're presenting with, and that becomes the basis for your intervention. So this is kind of, to me, a very narrow, almost tunnel-visioned model and understanding of children, and it's certainly not based on any science or any good science, because the reason why we don't have any physical tests or even psychological tests for children to help us with having, if you like, an independent source of data in the same way that a blood test or an X-ray might give you an independent source of data to help you understand whether at a physiological level this is a particular syndrome that you're diagnosing has some way of being evidenced. So because we don't have that, what we end up doing is we end up focusing on a few behaviors, and they become the target of whatever intervention you're doing. So if in the case of ADHD, your treatment model is about reducing attention, improving attention span, reducing hyperactivity and impulsivity, and that's what your treatments are targeting. But, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, Peter, when you see children who present with these types of behaviors, there are so many other possible differences that are going on in their lives that it seems to me crazy that we limit ourselves to just these few areas of behavior by which to construct an intervention. So, for example, you might have young person who comes in where you find out in the course of the interview that they're presenting that at school they've got some learning difficulties. They're feeling quite embarrassed about that, and they have kind of some low self-esteem, but they've also figured out when they play the class clown, it takes attention away from having to do the things that they find really hard to do. Then the next person who comes along, you find out that they tell you a story which involves the family having been through domestic violence, and that this is a young person who has had to be alert. He's seen his mum in danger, and he's ended up phoning the police. And I'm taking here bits and pieces from, you know, real cases that I've dealt with. And then the next person who comes along, you find out that there's a family history of allergies and that they had eczema and asthma since they were young, and they've got all sorts of eating difficulties. And yet the next one who comes along, you find, is actually a very bright kid who's got a really curious mind. And he's finding himself getting really bored quite quickly in lessons, and talks about not feeling stimulated. And then the next one who comes along, you find out that there's a father who's having very little contact and erratically contact. You know, each of those might present and have presented with these symptoms that could be funneled into this narrow diagnostic category. And then we'd miss all of these specifics about their stories. And with each of those families, what might prove to be meaningful and helpful can be very different. And that is exactly my clinical experience. One of the things that I do in my clinical practice, and I've been doing this for many years, is, and this is part of being part of a big international set of projects, and they're kind of led by an American psychologist called Barry Duncan, who is very focused on developing methodologies that can be used at a service level to help with recovery. So one of the things that I've been doing for many years is I use a very brief rating scale. It just has four items, and it's called the outcome rating scale. And so young people and parents fill this in at the start of each session, and then we put the scores on a graph, and it just gives me an idea about how they perceive themselves to be doing in themselves, in their family relationships, at school and with friends, and then just overall. So it's a very sort of quick and dirty, way of getting some feedback from the families about how they're doing. And this goes onto a graph, and so we can track whether what we're doing is making any difference. And if what we're doing is not making any difference, so after a number of sessions, after the fifth session, that's the kind of rule of thumb that we have, we're not seeing any changes, we can do a number of things. I usually have a chat with the family. Are we doing the right thing? Have we got the right people in? Do we maybe need to have some meetings with school? What else could we be doing? Or I ask permission from the family. I want to take this to our team meeting, as I want to get some more opinions. Or it might be that we conclude that maybe somebody else might be good for somebody else to be involved instead of me. So I've been evaluating the outcomes, if you like, of the work that we're doing and the work that I'm doing myself in my clinic and the team that I work with. And it's been encouraging because what we are finding is that taking this non-diagnostic model, working with the specifics that the families and the children themselves want to see change, rather than focusing on the narrow area of symptoms and controlling symptoms, seems to be associated with positive outcomes for most of the people I see, and that the size of those changes actually approach the size that we see in research, which is very encouraging because most of the research that we have seems to find that clinical services outcomes are a long way off the sorts of outcomes that you see in research. So, for example, in research with various conditions that we have using psychotherapeutic and using even pharmacological approaches, typically finds for most common mental health problems around 70% of people will make significant improvements and will be a lot better after receiving the treatment. Whereas if you look at recovery rates from real-life services, they're down at somewhere like 15% or maybe 20%. You know, they are a long way off. But the people we're discharging from our service, we're finding improvement rates of around 75%. And this is based on data we've been collecting for a couple of years now, which, again, approaches what you find in research. And we're also finding that we're having less people than other similar services in our area that are going on to become long-term patients. And we've got a much less number of people who are going on to become inpatient at psychiatric inpatient units. So we seem to be better at helping them, better at discharging them, and much better at preventing that slip into becoming a chronic patient.
Sammy,
all the complications it entails.
Yes. Sammy, how many of these kids do end up on medication that you're treating, or is it entirely medication-free?
There are quite a few people that I'm involved with who are on medication, and they're nearly all because I've inherited them on medication. So nearly all the work that I do is actually working with people, weaning them off medication. And we do that very successfully. Because if they stay on medication, it's very hard to discharge them. And you don't really want to discharge people who are on medication. Now, I do...
Sammy, let me interrupt for a minute. See, in America, discharge means from a hospital, but you mean to discharge from your clinic.
From the clinic, yeah.
Yeah, so, in this country, we usually think of discharging being from a hospital.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah.
Let me ask you something else.
Thanks for that clarification.
Yeah. Let me ask you just a couple of brief questions about all this to help just get a little clearer for me and other people, I think. In most cases, are you seeing the children with family members? And how often do you see them alone?
Right, okay. I mean, that's an interesting question. And I think the real advantages of having operated this model is that I've been able to be a lot more flexible, and I've created a lot more time. The way our service is working in the UK is that we are in the National Health Service divided into geographical areas. So I am a consultant. I am the consultant child psychiatrist for a particular geographical area around the city of Lincoln, where I live. And then other consultants in our county have other geographical areas. So what's happened with many of the other consultants, because they're operating a more biomedical model, and because a lot of their young people are on medication, they tend to see them for a lot longer and a lot less frequently. But what happens is their caseload builds up and builds up and builds up because they're not discharging from
better?
The clinic.
Yeah.
They're not discharging from the clinic many people, whereas because I'm doing work, I'm discharging from the clinic, and it creates more space to see new people. And since doing that, I've actually had the time to be able to be flexible according to what the families I'm working with, according to their feedback about what they about what we decide together would be helpful. So with some people, I'm doing mainly one-to-one work, and that's by their choice. And this will often be the older adolescent group who are wanting some time themselves. With other people, I'm doing family work, and I probably do more family work than I do one-to-one work, but I certainly do both. But I'm also involved in various other projects that we run. So as well as doing supervision clinics, like we have something called the five-session clinic, which is a supervision clinic where cases are not improving after five sessions. So it's just to kind of let's generate some ideas about what we might do differently. We do something called a one-session clinic now. This is something we started in the last year, where for some families that come for an assessment meeting or that maybe have presented following a self-harm episode at our local hospital, we get the sense that they don't need much, but it might be really beneficial to have all the family together and just to have one session, and that they know that that's what we're going to do. We're going to have one session where we're going to bring the family together so that they can think about and talk together and openly about, and we facilitate this discussion and give feedback and so on about how they might move forward from this particular crisis or particular thing. And we also do group work. So one of the groups that I'm involved in facilitating is using a model that is from American. You know Howard Glasser, don't you, and the Nurtured Heart Approach?
Howie's a very, very dear friend. I've written the foreword to his new book.
Yes. So Howard did some training with us a few years back, and we've adapted his ideas into a kind of more British-centric, and we've got a four-session workshop in which we invite parents in and we use those ideas, the Nurtured Heart ideas. So we do a variety of things and we are constantly evaluating what we do. And if things are not working, we try something else.
This is wonderful. I love your description of things. Now, it's interesting language difference. When you're talking about children, you often call them people. And I think in our country, and I think that this says something negative about our country, when we say people, we almost always mean adults. And when we talk about children, we always say children. We almost never say people. Have you noticed that difference? I think this is a real difference.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I was using the phrase young people.
You often just talk about them as people, which I think is great.
Yeah.
Now, how often
I mean,
Sandy,
I have to say I do love working with kids, and I love the ideas that they come up with.
Yeah.
And there's something about the energy of young people that can be quite infectious. So I do find that a lot of the family work that we do tends to be quite light-hearted, tends to have a lot of humor in it, and tends to be focused on positive things and accomplishments that people... Because one of the things that happens when you're in a difficult time, when you're trouble or in trouble, and people are saying how annoying you are and how irritating you are, is what can go missing is your strengths, your resources, and all kids have something that they're good at. So I often just spend quite a lot of time talking to kids, getting them to tell me about things that I often, things like, what have you learned in the last year? Just tell me one thing that you've learned in the last year, because kids are learning things all the time. And they usually will come up with something, even if it's a computer game or something. I just get them to talk about it, because I just love that energy that young people have, that when you can engage that energy, a lot of creativity can start happening.
I love everything you're saying, Sammy. How often are you working alone with children and families, and how often with someone else as a partner?
Most of the work that I do is actually alone, and I think this is largely a resource thing. But what we do is we come together regularly. We have regular supervision clinics. And I also do joint work in a kind of dipping in and out model. So some of the people in the team that I work with, where I'm a consultant to that team, they are seeing young people or families, and maybe every fourth or fifth session, we have a review meeting all together where we kind of take a step back and look at where we're at and plan whether they need to carry on and so on. So that's a kind of dipping in and out of work model. And most of that dipping in and out of work tends to be joint sessions.
Do you think there's a clinic in the United States that works in such a lovely fashion as you're describing? Do you know anybody?
Well,
child psychiatrist,
I mean, a lot of the really creative family therapists came from the United States.
Oh, no, I'm asking specifically.
Child psychiatry was originally very, very anchored if you look at some of the early pioneers of family therapy, many of them were doctors, many of them would consider themselves child psychiatrists.
No, I'm asking a different question.
Yeah.
I mean, I come from that tradition. You know, I was a medical student. I went across the country to see Murray Bowen do family therapy.
Well,
I was the first person to do family therapy at the State University of New York when I was an intern. I know about those traditions. But when you talk about your work in the clinic, I don't have a sense that I know a medical center where I can find that in the U.S. And I'll leave it at that and not put any pressure on you to respond. There are fabulous family therapists all across the United States.
Yes.
I'm thinking more about, and we have a great tradition of family therapy here,
mm-hmm.
which I view myself a part, but the medical centers just not going so good. Do you want to take a minute? We've only got about 2 minutes left, and anything new and exciting you just want to let us know about, in addition to the fact that we're actually going to have to get to do a conference together in the summer of 2015 in London, which I'll mention for the last time. And it'll be up as soon as we know about it, and that's going to be, we know the dates. I'll put it up, folks, on our various sites. But anything in particular? Do you have a new book coming out and a new project you just want to mention?
Well, I'm always involved in various projects. I guess the one that I'm most involved with at the moment is something called outcomes-orientated approaches to mental health. So this is kind of an expansion of the things that I've been talking about, and it is building on the work that particularly people like Barry Duncan introduced me to with his Heart and Soul of Change project. And again, there's another example of a fantastically creative and pioneering American who is dedicated to trying to transform mental health services across the world into something much more humane and recovery focused. excuse me. So with that, we're, you know, developing these ideas about feedback, ideas about how you turn this into whole service models. We've got some e-learning. We are developing databases and things that we can try and help with implementation projects, and we're involved in a number of implementation projects in different parts of the National Health Service. And the book that I'm working on at the moment is an edited volume with some colleagues. We've put together a critical autism network. There's a number of people after the publication of the Myth of Autism book that became very interested in
this
work.
We have to end now. It makes me think I should have you back fairly soon, Sammy, to talk about autism. We haven't even touched on that. This has been a wonderful interview. Sammy Timimi, last name is spelled T-I-M-I-M-I. Sammy, his first name is S-A-M-I. Child psychiatrist in Great Britain. Thanks for being on the show. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.